what I'm trying to outline to you today is what kind of project I spend most of my time with, and like how we think a certain computation should and might be done. It all looks very good, but has been pretty time consuming so far, and despite all hopes that one might have been done by now and present some results, there's still no final results. But what I can show is where we are, what works, and what hopefully will work in a matter of weeks. And I'll give you some flavor then in the end, like how things might look. So the basic quantity is this. It's sort of the first maybe I should say about the setting and the phase diagram, since that's how people typically start their talks here. I'm living on the temperature axis. The Baryon chemical potential is zero for this talk. So this is thermal feed theory, and what we are trying to do is compute the free energy in the symmetric phase. Since we all know that there have been a lot of talks here by various people that there do exist lattice computations of this quantity, which go across the phase transition temperature, which then varies. And the value of the phase transition temperature is of course given by the number of quarks, so that can be obtained on the lattice. We've all heard how beautiful lattice computations can be done there. And then typically lattice data go up to a couple of times the critical temperature, and we are asking like, how does one really approach the perturbative limit? Does one, or what can one do about it? So in this talk, while everything will be centered about evaluating this basic functional integral, I tell you what has been done in four dimensions: lattice, perturbation theory, and some resumations. And then I'll tell you what one kind of setup we think might be very advantageous in this respect. I give you the status of where we are, and then if there's time, give a couple of highlights, like show you some techniques if people are interested, and then really state what has to be done to finish this. There's two publications so far, the setup and some techniques, and hopefully there's more pretty soon. So it's as simple as that, just compute an integral. It's the usual Euclidean action up here of thermal field theory. The fields are periodic now. In imaginary time tau, which is here, the time integral is discrete. That goes from 0 to 1 over t, t being the temperature. So the temperature sort of gives you the confinement radius of this imaginary time. So things live in autoros here. It's just the basic setup one starts with. And then one is asking, like, why doesn't one just compute it with first principle methods, since we do have the lattice? So people did it, of course. This has been a lot of work done in the 90s. For getting an idea of what is so hard there. In finite temperature field theory, one has to discretize with two different numbers, so the box is not symmetric anymore. You have a time extension for the box, so you have nt lattice sites in the time direction, and then you have ns cubed direction for your spatial volume. Then as you know, on the lattice there's a single dimensional parameter a. This is the lattice spacing, so you have to connect that to physics, and so you can really say what your numbers that you get from the lattice are. Okay, yeah, of course. I mean, yeah. You will typically do some, I mean, in pure SUN, of course, you would take the string tension, or I mean, you would typically take some parameter that is easy to compute and then see what one can match there. The extrapolations one then really has to do are first of all the thermodynamic limits. So you need a big volume. That means that these NS has to be a lot larger than this NT, and of course you need a continuum limit A to zero. So all of this means that since the temperature here is really controlled by this parameter NT, by your temporal extent of the lattice, that the whole method with present day computers only works up to a few to a few TC. So these are the limitations on the method. In principle, there are no objections to do these computations for all range and temperature, but that just means that you have to have incredibly, for large temperatures, large lattices, and have an even bigger spatial volume. So there's just some constraints on the computer time.
There's another limitation.
Of course, yeah. Sure. That's a complete hard problem which I haven't even discussed here. So this would only be sort of the setup for doing the pure gauge computation. And then, of course, introducing fermion mass is a whole different story. We all know how hard that is. So. So in principle, this is a very qualitative sketch now, what people got in the 90s. Here's a couple of names associated with these lattice computations. I'm not going to discuss any technical details since I really want to concentrate on the analytic work one can do there. In principle, everything has been scaled here now to the critical temperature. So at one expects the phase transition. So the free energy or the pressure, which is just equivalent, is expected then to go from a small number to a high number. This high number in this case should be 1, since everything has been scaled to this ideal gas limit. So in a way, the free energy is in the non-interacting case, of course, just counting the numbers of degrees of freedom, just counting the gluons and fermions. So one would expect that at high temperatures, this curve goes up to 1 in these units. And what has been measured so far is say out to a few TC. One seems to reach a plateau, and then one would expect that one very slowly approaches this ideal gas limit. There are some technical issues with computing, with relating the critical temperature and lambda MS bar and with normalization here, but I don't really want to get into that. That's a whole discussion by itself. Well, I just want to add that this qualitative picture is true for zero fermion content of the theory as well as for theories with fermions. The numbers change a little bit, but just this behavior, which I wanted to outline. We've all seen these plots in a couple of talks here. Why don't we just concentrate on the lower one? Everything here has been scaled now again to the same units, T over TC, and the pressure over the ideal gas pressure. And one sees that this black line is now the pure gauge theory, and the other lines are some QCD-like theories. Of course, the quark masses are not the real quark masses. But what one sees from here is that the picture remains the same. One at temperatures a few times, the critical one doesn't get to this ideal gas limit, but one reaches some kind of plateau and then expects some approach at higher temperatures.
The top plot makes clear that without the blue-green red curve, TCs that occur, right. The pure gauge one is a very different TC.
Right.
So I'm not sure it's fair to plot the pure gauge one on the bottom plot like this. The physics of the phase transition
right.
of the pure gauge theory is it's a fully about loops and so on. Right?
Of course.
The physics in all the other ones involve
right.
the chiral symmetry order around.
Sure. All this discussion at the moment is very schematic. I just want to indicate some trends, and then, of course, one can discuss what really are the degrees of freedom driving the transition here. But this is just a different matter. What is of concern here now, however you normalize this axis here, you will always see there's some kind of plateau, and it doesn't reach 1 yet. That is the message that we get from the lattice at this point. I would say that's fair to say. So. Of course, at that point, what people did were taking the functional integral expanded perturbatively in powers of the coupling. So here's the series, and here's a couple of names which are associated with all these red constants here. So the series has been computed up to the G5 level. Here's a couple of diagrams just for people who are. We need to see some. what one notes is that this series is non-analytic in the coupling, so it's not a series in G squared, it has G cubed, it has a G4 log G, but all these are effects that arise in a well-known way in thermal field theory. It's a physics connected with Debye screening and Hall thermal loop resummation. So the real expansion parameter is G, since one has a parameter, this Debye mass over T, that one can expand physics in. So all these coefficients are known analytical, so one can do wonderful plots. Again, this is just a sketch of the whole thing, disregarding any scale dependencies, so the coupling has been fixed as the coupling at a typical Matsubara mode for the experts. So this is now a vastly different temperature range than in the plot before. This goes out to about 1,000 times TC, not only to 5 TC or so. The features are still the same. The lattice data I've plotted here, so up here would be 5 TC or so. These are these black dots. And the perturbative series just doesn't show any sign of convergence at any of these temperatures. As one sees, the blue curve is the leading term, the G squared. And then if you have the cubic, quartic, G5 term, one just see this whole thing is fluctuating. The perturbative series cannot interpret it in this very naive way in this case. So the question is now, can one do anything sensible by, say, doing resummations as has been done in various other theories, or is there a more fundamental limit associated with this expansion? One limit surely is what I call the lindacy here. So what one knows for the free energy is that at order G6, one hits infrared problems, so all diagrams of all orders are of the same magnitude. One can see this by pure power counting. If one plugs in these thermal field theory Feynman rules, and so one knows that already the next order after G5 is not perturbative anymore. So this is something where all diagrams contribute. So one might really question if the series up to here makes any sense only based on that argument, and one really sees here that it's not perturbative in this regime. Of course, at asymptotic temperatures, coefficients get smaller and smaller.
When you say it's non-perturbative, what you mean is that the...
I mean, there's no...
can't be computed using diagrammatic.
Right, factor. Right. I would call this a naive perturbative expansion. If you expand...
The expansion goes to the 6th, to the 7th,
right,
and so on.
Right.
So it's not the mean complex expansion, the Serdy breaks down. It's a way of computing the coefficients in the expansion.
Right, course. Yeah, I would call this the naive perturbative series, and it's not that naive anymore since one has all these non-analytic terms in it, but at least this way it doesn't make sense to speak about it. So I'd be very unfair now to a couple of people in this room by not mentioning their great work in big detail, since there's just no time for it. So Eric was involved in a couple of these computations. Edmond, who is here, was involved.
The first two collaborations have representatives that have spoken.
Yes, so they had time to present the work here. Yeah. So one might just look at the picture again first. The first two groups actually. So this is Eric's group. This is Edmond's group. The green stuff have done some. Some analytic work which is a lot deeper than this naive perturbative series I've shown. In the one case, one is doing some self-consistent approximations with some skeleton diagrams and then incorporating hard thermal loops. And Eric really, I think Mike Strickland gave the talk here, right?
Yeah.
So they've done some incredible two-loop hard thermal loop computation where one really then fixes the mass. Like one should, namely with a variational principle. One knows that the free energy has a minimum, so one can really do this at two loop. They've done this, and just just the result is not as one would have liked to be. But this is a very clean computation. Here one really gets where one wants to get. So the goal always is at large temperatures, perturbative series or any perturbative approach should be fine. And then of course one wants to connect to latest data. So this looks like a very nice feature that one can get in Edmond and Bizot and Repan's approach. But I really don't have time to discuss it here, and it has been discussed, so one can easily look it up on the web. The approach I want to discuss here is a combined setup. So what we try to do is try to use perturbation theory where it works very well, and then use lattice where that works very well, and see if we can match the two things. The basic idea actually again comes from Eric. He has written a series of papers in like around 95, I think it was. How to do an effective theory setup in this framework. So I think the philosophy of doing an effective theory setup is very well known. So I just mentioned here that whenever one has a scale hierarchy, and for sure here we do have one, there's the energy of typical Matsubara modes, which is of the order of pi t's, and there's gt, etc., g square t. So we have different scales. So if they are separated, if the coupling is small, then I can definitely start integrating out heavy modes. So this way, if I start with four-dimensional QCD, it's well known that one arrives at a three-dimensional adjoint Higgs theory. So I've sort of integrated out even the time directional by splitting the fields in, say, AIs and A-knots. These A-knots are now massive scalars, massive adjoint scalars. So these are Higgs's of the theory, and the massless modes are collected here. This sort of represents now the effective theory of the long-range modes, of the soft modes in the theory. So all the heavy modes sit in loops and have been integrated out. So the effect of heavy modes sits in the parameters of the effective theory now. And I've cut off the effective theory here. Of course, an infinite tower of operators will be created if I integrate out all kinds of loops. What we are doing is truncating the theory at a super renormalizable level. So this is sort of technically very convenient to throw away these higher order operators and really stop at quartic order. And I'll argue later how power higher operators are power counting suppressed. So if one does this integration out, one relates parameters of the 3D effective theory with parameters of the four-dimensional theory QCD one started with in the beginning. So parameters we have now is the three-dimensional coupling, then this quartic coupling and the mass, and these are all now expressed by doing this matching computation in terms of the temperature. So the temperature was the only scale we had in QCD. So of course all these parameters must have a behavior which goes with the temperature. And this is just what one gets at next to leading order. I've only displayed here results here for NF equals zero, no fermions, but it's just trivial to include fermions in at this level here, since this theory always is a bosonic one. So the problems of dealing with fermions has completely gone. It can be put into these coefficients here. So there would just be some NF dependence in these reduction coefficients. What one should note for the following, if I show some plots how this stuff behaves, is that of course one can now start and study this three-dimensional theory by itself as it stands. Then it would be a theory with three parameters, G, lambda, and M. But since we put it in a different setup, namely we really get it from this reduction from four-dimensional QCD, it's only one parameter theory. The one parameter is T, so I can express every parameter in terms of it, or if I stay on this level studying the three-dimensional theory, everything can just be expressed in one of these parameters, say. So I typically choose Y, so the mass parameter, since these things are just related. So the if once one has noticed that one can do this reduction, integrating out the hard modes, it's a quick step to write down the pressure again. So here's the pressure again, normalized, so it starts with a 1. So the pressure now gets contributions from both theories, from the four-dimensional QCD, which is cut off at some intermediate scale, and then of this effective theory, which goes up to the scale and goes and includes all the soft modes. Yeah. It's, I mean, formally it's between T and GT.
It's between T.
Yes.
Okay.
So it would be, I mean, right, yeah. Square root G times T or so. Right. Exactly. I actually give this parameter a name here. It's mu 3. And of course, these matching parameters always cancel when you do matching computations. So there's no magic about it. The setup now is so that there are these hard modes, which come from the four-dimensional sector still. So one has to compute. One can compute these in a naive perturbative series. So this is not really a naive perturbative series. It goes with G squared. And they're just, I've just indicated this is the order 1 term, order G squared term, the order G4 is here, and then it just goes on. Times, or plus then, the free energy of this effective theory. So here I can then also say, either I do perturbation theory, so that would just reproduce this wildly oscillating series one has seen before, or I treat this by other means. And this is really what one should do, since one knows that this three-dimensional theory is confining, so there's no way to do perturbation theory there. One should really treat it non-perturbatively. And this is now the whole idea of the setup. So do what you can by perturbation theory, do these hard modes, do the integration out at this hard scale, and then do the rest on the lattice, namely this theory of the soft modes, this three-dimensional theory. So this is just this idea here. One should measure this free energy of the 3D theory and then compute the rest.
And how do you decide down to what temperature you can trust it? Is it the requirement that GT has to be small compared to Titan?
Oh, you mean where I should set the scale?
No, the whole.
The whole sum.
Move the contract down a bit. You did sort of two things. Just the fact that you're splitting into a vector theory means that you're assuming that there's a separation scale.
Right.
And you also did a plus dot dot dot. You truncated your three-dimensional.
Exactly. Yes.
So I guess what I'm asking is, which is, as you try to come down in temperature, what breaks down?
What you do is look for higher order operators to become important.
But isn't what happens first is that that whole separation of scale collapses?
Right. You mean before these operators come in?
Yeah, you decrease the temperature.
Of course,
it doesn't just seem to be that those higher dimension operators suddenly are important. Instead, it's the whole
all hell breaks.
GT hierarchy is indistinguishable.
Yeah. So as a handle, how to control this? If the separation still holds, what one would do is again expand now this new function and really then see if there's any sign of convergence at the typical temperature one is looking at. And then say if higher order terms in G now get important again, then one would certainly not trust this whole setup again. So there's really these two things one has to look for. That's right.
And to just argue at the level of the convergence of the calculations leading to the effective theory, I mean, when you compute the coefficient of the effective theory,
yes,
the fundamental one, the pre-expansion in G square, and to just look at the convergence of that expression and draw some conclusions. If it's rapidly converging, it means that temperature is still somehow trustful in what we're doing.
Yeah, of course one can look at that, but then, I mean, this is somehow on this level again, so of course I can say that these first coefficients that I've computed by this reduction are still trustworthy, but I really have to control what happens next. Sure.
The coefficients of those higher dimension operators now?
Yes.
So you're still right about the transparency?
Yeah, these are computed. This, of course, everything is known to some order. Of course, there are still, averted the challenges to do this one order further. So this is already next to leading in some improvement scheme. This is the fastest apparent convergence. But with this all technicalities. This, this just can be driven to crazy accuracy if one needed it. And higher order operators, the coefficients of those are surely known in lowest order, but not to any crazy accuracy or so. But I'll comment later really on what they contribute. There's a little bit messy transparency. I will now comment a little bit on how one really measures this three-dimensional contribution, assuming that all these perturbative matching things have been done, and these hard contributions have been contributed. So first, what one has to do on the lattice is, of course, one typically measures correlators. So one gets them by just putting derivatives on this function integral. So that's an easy step. But then, of course, to get the free energy from these correlators, from these derivatives, I really have to integrate back. And this introduces now some ambiguity in the setup, which until now was just exactly defined in steps that can be driven very accurate. So what one has to do is integrate back over these correlators, over these derivatives, and introduce an integration constant, which then one has two choices to fix. One choice is fix it where you trust perturbation theory. So go to incredibly high temperatures, do a perturbative computation of this three-dimensional guy, and fix your... So y0 is now this parameter of the theory. So if I know the temperature, I know what y0 is. So if I fix at some crazy temperature this one perturbatively, I can certainly do the integral and get my three-dimensional free energy here. So the idea, what we do in practice is we go to incredibly high temperatures, 10 to the 11 times lambda ms bar, fix things there perturbatively. So this is certainly a point where we see the perturbative series to make sense, to converge very rapidly.
Naive perturbative series converge.
Right. So this is where we really trust all this stuff. So here we fix a constant that cannot be gotten from the lattice, and then we do this evolution down to smaller temperatures on three-dimensional lattice. So by saying all this, there's a couple of highly technical points which one then just has to. I mean, there's a list of things which now have to be computed. Since one computes on the lattice, one wants a result in MS bar, one needs to relate to schemes. So this introduces some computations one will have to do in lattice perturbation theory as well. And unfortunately, this also goes to the same level than the perturbative one, namely to for loop. Since these matching computations between these two schemes have not been finished to date, we're missing some of these for loop guys here. The best we can do is just parameterize this coefficient, this integration constant here, delta f. So I do so, and on the next slide I think one sees a plot where there's a parameter e0, and this is a consequence of not having done this computation yet. We have to have a parameter here. The other choice one can do to fix this parameter is one can now integrate out the next scale. One can now realize in the three-dimensional theory, again, the Debye mass is a heavy scale. It's of order gt, so if I'm looking for very soft physics, order g squared t, I can certainly integrate out these scalars. So where one arrives is then at a pure Young-Mills theory. And this is then only a one-parameter theory, so this can certainly be, you can certainly get a number for that from the lattice without having to fix any integration constant whatsoever. So this is then, if one does the second step of integrating out fields, then one has a way of simulating even this constant, getting even this number from the lattice.
That case wouldn't be very sensitive, expand
at
scale GT. I mean, we should make a special
scale.
Right.
Right. I mean, one will again have this hierarchy picture in mind, and then one would have to check if it really holds, of course. This is all parametric. This is purely parametric counting, how a setup could work. Right. And in the end, of course, you have to see what your orders of magnitude are. We certainly hope so, yes. I mean, it
that would be the case if you need a problem comes with G6 somehow.
Right. So if the main problem is not knowing the G6, then even the leading term of this would be a major contribution to the free energy. If there's some huge non-perturbative effect coming from all orders, then of course this will break down a lot sooner.
So it could be that the G squared G plus GT effective theory is what Fourier separate T from GT and G squared T.
Right.
But you can in practice further separate GT from G squared T.
One will see if that works in practice. Yeah, I mean the hope is that if these G6 terms, so in a way summing up all these G6 effects corresponds to summing up this Linde C of diagrams in a diagrammatic language. So if that works, then one would say there is a hope that this works. One can get the constant from there.
Okay, like, that's yeah. Interesting also by itself, just to see if in the problem.
Right. 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 So I think I should just show now what we've done first, of course, is take this prescription, so do this perturbative fixing here, and play with this parameter, see if the whole setup makes any sense. This is the outcome. This is already stuff that is almost a year old. And everything that has followed since, I give them next. So the status now is we add up these terms that we've split before. So there are these four-dimensional hard modes. These we include up to some perturbative level, to the three-loop level. Then there's this three-dimensional lattice Monte Carlo simulation of these condensates. Here we only include one condensate. There's arguments that the other one is suppressed, but I'll also show some data which shows that it's first of all small and second of all harder to compute. That's why it's not in this plot. And then there's this integration constant E naught. So what we get is again the same plot we saw before. Lattice data are the dots here, and everything is extremely sensitive on this parameter E naught. So whatever we would put in for E naught between 0 and 14 here, I mean that. One can just go more crazy if one likes.
Does E naught equals 0 mean that at a temperature of 10 to the 11th and as far temperature 10 to the 11th in these units, the free energy is exactly Stefan Boltzmann? Is that what E naught equals 0 means? Delta F equals 0.
Everything goes to Stefan Boltzmann, of course.
But what does E naught equals 0 mean?
It just means that we set this integration constant to 0.
Right, but wasn't that integration constant? That integration constant was the free energy at...
It's, right. It's the three-dimensional part of it. The 3D subpart, so the soft mode contribution to the free energy at high temperatures. And of course, at high temperatures, everything is dominated by the hard stuff anyways. I mean, all of this just can't be distinguished as high temperatures. But down here, one really sees what it does. So the soft modes make this effect. So the only message one would get from a picture like this is, even though one doesn't know what E0 is, if one now finds any methods to compute it, and one ends up with a number of the order 10, one would be very happy. Since then, there would be hope that things connect, like in the other approaches that we've seen before. These dots here are statistical errors. So
could you go back first?
Sure.
Definition.
So what E0 is a, one fixes this constant by three loops, so the three loop coefficients are known, and then one doesn't know the for loop guy, and this is what E0 represents, for loop plus higher. So if one, if E0 represents what we don't know about the perturbative series here at 10 to the 11 lambda ms bar.
Wait, where are the three loop constants?
Oh, it's I've not spelled it out here. This delta FMS bar is this guy minus its three loop content. So three loop, everything up to three loop has been known for quite a while. So that is always subtracted. That is already included in this perturbative setup of the free energy.
It's a G to the six.
Yes, it's G to the 6 is scaled out since that's the scale, yeah. Everything is dimensionless since G6 has been scaled out, right.
And is the comment in B enter anywhere in your next transparency?
Sorry, the...
Part B there. Is that...
No, not yet. We're only dealing with part A here in this plot.
A and B are two alternative paths.
A and B are two ways to fix this delta F.
One way is just to guess.
If
you say that B is the way to calculate E0.
Right. It could be if this whole setup works.
That's not what he's saying. You're saying that part A is to do a perturbative calculation of E0.
Right.
Which is that's the thing that you haven't finished yet.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is it perturbative?
Part.
There's a coefficient to G to the 6 log G. Is that?
That's perturbative.
Is that part of E0?
Yes.
So E0 is the G to the 6 log G, but not the G to the 6 underneath that.
Yeah, I mean, what you can't really say it since you don't have a scale at the log. So it's, I mean, at this point, it doesn't have any sense to parameterize it any further. Like splitting the log and the G to the 6, it's just, it's a number. And that's what you will see later on. I mean, of course, we are trying to compute the logs here right now. That's precisely this for loop computation. And then one will know a little bit more about this E0. Or we know the log part, and then you can really scale out the G6 part itself.
Is there any need to go? There's two possibly effective theories. One is where you integrate out the scale T.
Yep.
And the other is where you go another step, integrate out the scale GT,
sure.
Which is much more questionable.
Yeah.
Is there any need to take the second step at all?
It's, I mean, there are two alternatives, and we will for sure explore both. Mm-hmm. This one is simpler, so this one we do now. And then if there's any hope that this G6 term, which one computes here, is the dominating one, gives a huge contribution to the free energy and sort of does all this order 10 effect of this E0 or so, then one would say this setup has a chance to survive. And then we would really try to get the number from the lattice, really measure. But doing step B really requires a for loop lattice perturbation computation, and no one in the moment would even be willing to start it. This is just for philosophical reason. This is, if things here turn out or give a signal to behave nicely, then one, in the long range, one can think about really fixing things, really measuring things. But of course, one doesn't need this step. If one is fine with this argument, fix it at high T, perfect.
Isn't that the most sound from first principle data? I mean, the complete step, method A, the full loop calculation from
yes.
the matching point of view,
right.
followed by a full match calculation
right.
of the gauge theory plus the
of gauge theory plus the joint Higgs. Yeah.
In a way, that should be the true answer. That one should be also the indication the other one
yeah.
has a chance to work or not, but the other one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, well, but of course, you can always argue. I mean, all these. This constant can only be also be fixed at six loop. I mean, what? How do you control these higher?
The problem with B is that it's not at all clear that the G squared T modes really are alike compared to the GT modes.
Right. Sure.
Not even clear if the G6 is actually the dominant one or just the by mass sound.
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this is certainly the argument, while this is something one can do, and this will give then a hint of what can come next, or if this is the final answer. No, I mean, there's of course higher order corrections even to this F. I mean, then I can introduce some G to the A term or so. There's always this integration constant can only be fixed with an infinite perturbative series. This is what it is. And the argument is if this scale separation still holds, then one can sum up this series. One can measure the full coefficient. One can measure the full result. With all caveats.
Let me just
ask
you that. If you make the step A up to the end,
yes.
You have a result expected by the right up to and including order 86?
Sure. Yes.
But there's no obstacle to further improving that without taking step B, right? You could just add more operators.
You can add operators. The setup up to here is purely perturbative, and then you measure these correlators on the ladder. So all the matching can be driven to some accuracy, whatever you like. Sure. Sure. So I think just to flash this again. So this is really what one is aiming for now. Get a handle on this E0. So this E0 is a G6 term. So it was in this. If one views it in this four-dimensional perturbative series, it has a G6 log G and a G6. And of those, the log is still computable perturbatively, and the G6 itself, the constant, is a pure non-perturbative term since it sums up all these orders. So the aim now is try to compute the log of this and see how big it is, and get the rest from other operators if one can measure them. So I'm not sure if I just to show you some data, since Karel Rummukainen is our person working on the lattice, he gives us all these correlators. This is a typical example for one of these correlators, this A0 squared measured here. What one does is one does perturbation theory on the lattice and in a continuum up to three loop, and subtracts it from the data, and then one can really do a clean continuum limit. So this is data at different beta g's, at different lattice spacing, and this is the limit letting spacing to zero here. So one sees for this specific correlator, which had been included in this plot I showed before, things are under control, while for this quartic correlator, which had not yet been included in the plot I showed, things look like this. Oh, this is dirty. So the continuum limit would be red points here. So here we measure the quartic guy minus its perturbative part. Here we actually know the for loop terms, since these are some simpler diagrams in this case. It's related to the fact that these are really the guys having a quartic coupling. So you have to take a derivative with respect to it. These are usually simpler than the pure gauge part. So here we know a lot more perturbatively, but still what we don't know is where this... So the perturbative end would be over here. So we are missing a non-perturbative constant here, which would have to be fixed by this data. So it seems that still at 10 to the 50 TC, we're not there. So this emphasizes. The perturbative limit is out here. So temperature axis goes down here like always, and we have subtracted the for loop perturbative part from the correlator. So we would think at large temperatures we should hit the perturbative limit zero, and we don't. So we are still missing. We're still missing a for loop constant, which can be measured, of course, this way. So this is a G6 constant. But one clearly sees here that perturbation theory, even on for loop level, is not enough.
It never converges.
Exactly. So, yeah. Exactly. So
that long-term contribution is B0, or is it something different? I'm totally confused.
No, no, this is something different. This has to do with, this has to do with trying to include the quartic condensate into the data, so integrating that back.
This is not about calculating zero.
No. This is trying to get the next operator into our series. And even there, some work is hidden, but the work this time is numerically. One sees that still things are not convergent. We need the plateau here, and we think we are not there. No, we need a constant. We can't fix that perturbance. There's a lattice constant. We need the constant on the lattice. This has nothing to do with the perturbative setup in continuum. Like E0 is a continuum number. So E0 is in the continuum. This is a lattice constant, but to convert a measurement on the lattice to the continuum, we need the lattice constant. One can either compute it, but we can't, and or one can measure it, and it seems we are not there yet. So
well,
so this.
Then
we go ahead. Yes, right. This, yeah. We've put our computing time in some other correlators so far. So this will still be improved, for sure. This is just to give a flavor why we still haven't included all the operators we should.
If you had that, then you would have, in order to integrate back, you would have to integrate in a two-dimensional space, not just in one variable.
No. These two variables are related. They all run with the temperature. So in a way, we only integrate over the temperature. So these x and y are just related. They both, if you integrate over y, there's an implicit relation. So I want. What is the time? I don't care.
5:53.
Okay, so I
you started at about 10 past.
Yeah. I should. What I wanted to show you in the end now is just some goodies of this perturbative setup that we've been grinding through for the last year or so. And to start that, I'll start some kind of an amusing setup we've run across. Namely, if right, okay, this is now pure continuum. So now I'll stop talking about these latest things. Now we are trying to figure out, you know. So if you start something like this, of course, what you need, it sounds trivial. One of course needs a complete set of diagrams with correct symmetry factors. What one might notice is that since we need vacuum diagrams, like any rules that one normally uses, these symmetry rules, just don't apply to get symmetry factors. So for example, if I take the rules that are in the appendix of Cheng Li, I just give the wrong factor even for the simplest diagram. So that's clearly not the way to go. The reason is that one doesn't have external things to hold fixed, and no unique way to number internal lines.
I'd say that is effective linear. Is it?
That's right.
Okay. So it's just a rule of Cheng and Li, or not?
Yes. No. Of course. It's easy if you think. I mean, it just comes from expanding an exponential. That's all.
Well, it's easy to get just from looking at the diagram and thinking about symmetry as well.
So okay. Yeah. You can even. Okay, sure. I mean, one can certainly invent rules for these things, and what we have not succeeded in doing is formulating rules that are valid to any order. So at higher order diagrams, we had. I'll show you some, and maybe you have some simple rules of seeing that. But we just thought that a more computerized approach would just be appropriate here. So this is basically what one then set up for the whole thing. Uli Heinz and Mark Achammer have brought us to some good ideas here, namely one should do the whole setup in terms of two PI functions, not only one PI diagrams. And it then goes just via standard functional analysis. So one sets up a skeleton expansion of the free energy. This is stuff that is known since the 60s how to do this. And the challenge now is, back in the 60s, the rule to describe these two particle irreducible diagrams was, oh, just draw them all and keep the two PI guys. So one clearly, to do an analytic setup here, one had to do better. So the first step was to get a closed equation for these guys that has been done. And then, of course, what you need to specify is just the Schwinger-Dyson equations of your theory. And that's, of course, a very well-known ingredient as well. So you have this whole tower of Schwinger-Dyson equations. They're all written in one line, but if you expand them, it gets a little more messy, and it's, of course, an infinite tower. But as far as telling a program, this is an easy thing to tell a program to just expand these things. So what one gets for the free energy then expanding is really some sums which consist on every order of some skeletons. So these are 2-loop, 3-loop, 4-loop, 5-loop skeletons, etc. And then something which is called ring diagram. So this resums all these lower order blobs, all these lower order insertions, which do not lead to 2PI. So while this is very systematic, one can then just write an algorithm which does it. So we've written an algorithm which just outputs it all the topologies one gets for these 2PI diagrams at 2, 3, 4, 5 loop levels, etc. If one waits long enough, one really gets all of them. The problem here being, and that really I think comes back to this question, if one can sort of see by eye these symmetry factors, that there are so many cases which are equivalent and which are not easy to see. I mean, some of theirs. It's very hard to do all these symmetry operations by eye. So this is why why at this step we were certainly safer to just expand the exponential and see what happens. So but once one have done this, you would just have a big list.
I can't see that first equivalent, the first example.
Oh.
Yeah, that first one down there.
Oh, this is. This is actually music. So you have two 3 circles here. Those are here. So these external ones, and then you have 3 spokes just connecting these circles. There, yeah. So it's
constructed in string and then pull it.
Yes. If you had a string model, you could certainly like flip it. So that was one of the difficulties. We weren't, of course, when we started, we just went ahead like drawing these things on the blackboard and fighting over symmetry factors, and then we just we realized after a while our set got smaller and smaller, and then we really wanted to find a generic rule how to do this, how to let someone else do it for you, and this guy just now does it for us. Oh, I was just going to show that once you have obtained your vacuum diagrams with symmetry factors, you also get endpoint functions by derivative. So take a derivative with respect to a propagator here, then you get a 2.2 loop function. And you can do this in 6 ways, cutting one line here. They're all equivalent in this topology in this Mercedes. So you get a 1/4 times this, which is just the correct symmetry factor for this 2-point function. So once one has done this setup, one can just take derivatives with respect to 2-point functions, 3-point functions, 4 vertices, and one gets all the other symmetry factors as well. So this is some of the basic ingredient. After this, one doesn't need any Chang-Li rules anymore. Anyways, so this is something one can automatize, and then just tell, in the end, tell your program what your favorite theory is. So we have a SUN plus edge on Higgs, so we have gluons, ghosts, scalars, all these vertices. So one just gets a list here of things one has to compute. The number of diagrams is not that huge yet at that level. So here's one one is on the order of 50 of these for loop skeletons. But if one then really, for the free energy, asks, like how many of these ring things I have to add, so just below here, I list all these three loop and for loop ring diagrams. Those are a lot. Those are of the order of 500. But what one I think can clearly see now is the efficiency, how these two PI expansion really works. I only need a couple of symmetry factors, and then by just plugging in self energies, which I get by derivatives on lower order guys, I'm done. So I don't need 500 symmetry factors here. I just need 10. So this is certainly a way how to control a higher order perturbative calculation without doing stupid mistakes like factors 2 or so. In the last, I think, 5 minutes, I want to show you some remarks on the other side of it, namely, how does one really compute these things now? And I think some of these techniques are really of general interest and not too well known to a general audience. So I just listed a couple of numbers and a couple of approaches here. I would call this the modern way of setting up a perturbative computation. Then if you just compare the difficulty level, if I do a for loop phi to the 4, I can certainly do it on paper. There's only two diagrams, there's only one skeleton. And since the vertex structure is extremely simple in phi to the 4, I have a one-to-one correspondence between a diagram I draw on paper and an integral I write down, a scalar integral. If I do the same thing with the Young-Mills theory, I certainly have to go to a computer, since assuming I work in covariant gauges, every propagator has two terms, every three vertex has six terms. I have nine lines here, six, three vertices, so I get 2 to the 9 times 6 to the 6. I get 25 million integrals just by multiplying out the Feynman rules. So this, and this is one diagram of the 500. So this is certainly something you don't want to do on paper anymore. And so the tool that most people are using these days is a program called Form. It's written by Jos Vermaseren, and this is a symbolic programming language. It works pretty much the same way as Mathematica. It applies some rules to something you give him, with the only difference, and that's a crucial one, that it already knows about physics. It knows about vectors, tensors, gammas, traces of gammas, and it can sort expressions on the hard disk just for the expert. So Mathematica always crashes, since it tries to sort things in RAM. And this thing just works on your entire hard disk. So this really works for computations, while Mathematica wouldn't. Form just works like you do computations on paper. You input an expression. So it's the same as writing an equation. Then you tell him, replace a three vertex by its Lorentz content or so. So it's just the same thing as you do line by line, with a big advantage, of course, that Form does not do these stupid mistakes going from page 10 to page 11 to omit a minus sign or so. So this really helps you keep in track of your minuses and factors too in these 25 million integrals. So
this responsible for the G minus
2? No,
it was the user who was. I mean, of course, it's a language you have to learn, and
the user didn't read the manual.
Yeah. That was the outcome of the discussion. So the strategy now is extremely simple. One has all these integrals and definitely doesn't want to compute them all. So what one does is one employs all kinds of partial integration relations one can get hold of. These typically reduce the integrals to a few basic ones, and these few basic ones then one computes. These basic ones usually have the nice structure of having a one upstairs and only the simple structure of propagators downstairs. These are all Euclidean integrals, while the thing one starts with clearly has a very messy structure, lots of scalar products, lots of different powers, a couple of different masses. So while this is straightforward, of course.
Look at that bottom line, very bottom line.
Oh, sorry. Just, of course, in the end, you have to compute these basic guys and then really specify what dimension you want to have your expansion in. So just expand these guys. In our case, it turned out that one can reduce everything to of the order of 10 integrals. So one has to compute 10 integrals here, and using all these relations, it gives you the 25 million different expression. And this is really the point where the computation is is stuck in the moment. So this is
sufficient depth in epsilon means that after you combine them and everything cancels, that's supposed to cancel, that you're still something left.
Yes, I mean, sufficient depth, I mean, we are shooting for the divergence. We just need the divergence. We just need the 1 over epsilon divergence. So we need all the higher order divergences. And we don't need constant parts. This is just some examples how things look. I just wanted to mention that the stages in the moment is, while this program, it's a big program, it has 5,000 lines, it checks off the order of 1 million of these relations. It gives us some big databases, the order of 100,000 lines of relations which just relate different integrals, and break everything down to about 10 of them. Oh, this is dialogue and Clausen function. No. I mean, this is an example of how things work at three. Oh, this might be interesting to you, Eric. This is the typical guys you computed back in 95. So now this database reduces them to just very simple integrals. While really computing this guy is some work, I guess, as you know. So this whole partial integration setup is very systematic and really eases computations a lot. One doesn't know in the beginning, since there's no simple rule how to figure out the minimal basic set of integrals yet. What we know is that these order 10 where we are now are mostly integrals one can do, like, I mean, say in a week per integral or so.
You mean
analytically? No, we need divergences. So divergences you can
a week of you staring at it, or a week of some
machine
grinding away at it?
No, just doing it by hand. I'm doing some basic method, some coordinate space Gegenbauer, and then you just break down everything.
So you get reducing the special functions.
Right. When the algorithm stops.
Okay, that means when you have exhausted all the rules.
Right. Of course, there's no upper cutoff on the number of rules I can include. I can always take more of these rules. But when...
Then you may discover that you can still combine them.
Right. A definite sign would be, the physics sign is, of course, I add up all diagrams, and then I get just some coefficients. This is all analytic up to now, some coefficients times these master integrals. If the gauge parameter cancels in these coefficients, then I'm pretty sure I'm at least close to the basic set. If the gauge parameter does not cancel, I still know that these guys must be linearly dependent. So of course the gauge parameter must cancel d dimensions already without having to do these expansions. So that's a very stringent check on how close one gets to these master integrals.
So you don't know that yet. You don't know that yet.
Yes, we know that a whole bunch of these cancel, but we are not there yet. We still have some left. So these order 10 is not the final answer yet.
So when you say it's checking debugging, it's not that you're in the middle of doing the 10 integrals. It's you're in the middle of doing the reduction to 10 integrals.
Right. On the other hand, these guys that we think are basic, we have done. So there's some or two-way approach. I mean, while you're waiting on the program to give you this things of yours, of course you do the integrals you think that are basic.
And at check. At the end of all this, you know, from the 25 million integrals reduced to 10, at the end you're going to get a nice plot saying E naught equals 10.2.
Right. Or maybe not.
Or what happens if it gives E naught equals, you know, 58?
Terrible. Yeah.
Your E naught would be an analytic result, right?
Right.
E naught would rational, or is it have zetas in it?
It would be rational. Zetas are only in the constant parts. The divergences are all rational numbers.
So
go ahead. No, of course. That's why one is really taking all this time. We need to employ every small check we have, since we know that for a while nobody's going to check this computation. So this is really what takes a long time at the moment. Just checking every line of the database, basically.
So do you know? I mean, often with experimentalists, there's a moment in history when they know the answer, but they're not telling anyone because they're busy checking and debugging. Do you know the answer or not telling us, or do you haven't even got it to spit out an answer for you yet?
Honestly, I don't know it. What we've done is, sorry, I should really end the talk now. So what we have done is trying to measure this coefficient on the lattice.
That's root B.
No, it's trying to get a handle on the, since this is a divergence, this for loop log is a divergence. Divergences you can see if you make A small enough. It should diverge logarithmically. It's not a very good fit, of course, you can do. But you might be able to see this. And then Kari has done some simulations which aim at, I mean, it looks like this. It's not a good fit. But if one takes a line, which is this guy here, 0.41, which someone goes through a lot of the data, then something which is very close to E0 is 9.5. So this is our hope. Our big hope that things might turn out nice. And just to if one now trusts this 9.5 here, then the red curve is what one gets. So this is okay. There is indication that
your form calculation is going to
produce some number.
It's going to give you a number.
Right. For sure. So, and then we'll see if it's 9.5 or not. There's some things omitted here, but it should be pretty close to it. Okay, I'm done.